been. We've got a few minutes now for questions. Can I ask the presenters this morning to come up and take part in this conversation? I just want to underline, for those of you who have never had to present in a public setting like this in a language other than your first language, I think there's a lack of awareness of the skill and the kind of bravery that it takes to do that. And I want to thank Fabio and Jean and Anne for that. I think they deserve it. Thank you. We're fairly forgiving about language in this country. We had a prime minister in the person of Jean Chrétien who spoke neither official language, so... Okay, so we have, as I say, probably time for three or four questions. If anyone would like to come up to the microphone and ask a question, we're all set.
Hi, I am Sou Patrício de Vocês. I'm a Brazilian, Daniel, and I'm sorry to give you bad news, but I'm going to ask you a difficult question. I admire very sincerely the work that Banco Real Microcrédito is doing. It's something that among the social entrepreneur communities recognizes incredible innovation and a beautiful approach. But, and something that has a potential of really changing the way of the financial system relates with society. But Banco Santander is part of, and please don't take this question personally or directly to your institution, but I'm talking about the Brazilian financial system, which is somewhat special in its relations to the nation, to the society. I mean, Banco Santander is part of a financial system in which your main two competitors, Itaú and Bradesco, the largest banks in Brazil, which are probably the most lucrative banks in the world right now, they hijack people on the streets. They create small shops with balloons and people with beautiful T-shirts and caps outside. They go in the streets and they literally bring these people by their arms into the shops offering, we have easy money for you. We want to borrow you money for people passing the streets, people who are poor in downtown areas who are completely financially illiterate. And these people buy money at 180% of interest rate a year, 150 to 180. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Credit cards charge 10 to 12% of interest rate a year from persons. 10 to 12% a month, sorry. So how can we explain how this financial system tries to explain this by the rate of energy plants, how do you by the non-payment, but this is proven to be wrong. So how can we explain that this kind of phenomenon happens only in Brazil and is totally unregulated? Why the government, why the central bank, the Federal Reserve doesn't regulate this? And how come the financial system wants to play a beautiful role like you're doing it and other banks are pretending to do and relates to society in such a way?
Okay. Have you forgotten to speak English, Fabio?
By the way, English is not my
this
native
might be
language
a time.
As well.
Well, I'd like to start mentioning that, yes, there is a movement. I think it started between 5 and 10 years ago, which was the outcomes of the financeiras. Yeah? And they were spreading credit with really, really high interest rates, yeah? And, I mean, just to have an idea, it's, 10, 15% a month. It's a lot. Of course, the Brazilian reality, it comes when you understand the economy and the story of the economy, you see that the banks not long time ago were charging this as well, but the inflation rate was a lot higher as well. But what I wanted to stick with is that I think that there is a movement that is pressuring changes on this sector. Not to mention, our president is the president of the Federation of Brazilian Banks, and I'm sure that, that the reason for it is because there are many supporters of this movement. We see that some financiers are shutting doors, and we'd like to have a lot of competitors doing microfinance as well. We do not. We are not happy with this. You know, just we are. No, we don't want. It's not the the intention of becoming the largest microfinance provider. If you can, that would be a pleasure. But that would be great if all of the banks in Brazil would do this. I think this movement it does exist. I think it is diminishing, and the reason for it is because the market and the consumers are getting a lot pressured. Are posing a lot of pressure in the financial industry towards better the conditions that the market has. Obviously, it doesn't happen from one day to another. It does take time. And also, if we were discussing about these things, I mean, why this thing still happened? Yeah, we were just to compare. We were reading some magazines here in Canada, and we were looking at the prices of some cars, and we were thinking, well, how cheap they are. Yeah, if compared to Brazil, some models that cost here, I don't know, $20,000 in Brazil may cost, just to have an idea, more than $100,000. And then the reason for it, of course, because there are taxes, but also because there is a market that pays for it. So I think that this, while the market is still accepting it, I think, of course, there is this there, but I think this is a movement that is changing, yeah? The consumers are not accepting these anymore, and I think it's a matter of time. I don't know if I addressed very, you know, your question, but I believe very much as one of the players doing microfinance, of course, not only microfinance, but being in the financial market, that this is a movement. We are seeing this, not only as a I'm also a consumer, and I also them crazy when I go to a bank, or even the bank, if this bank is the one I work for, and when I am charged quite highly. So I think this is the perception of the market, and the market is pressuring this for a change.
Okay. As I started out this morning, this is our guiding document today, and I want to go back to it, because the group that met on Tuesday to discuss this, their number one priority was to place microcredit for financial empowerment and improving health on the agenda of the G8 and the G20 meeting coming up in Canada. I don't know if Johannes, if you can offer some words of advice on that, or Jean or Anne, if you want to talk about, how do you do that? How do you get it on the agenda of those leaders?
Maybe I can, yeah. Well, I think, first of all, you need to get the development agenda on the G20 agenda, and that may be happening. The Koreans, who will be chairing the November summit next year, actually have asked to work with us, have asked us to advise them on how to do that, what might be some of the issues. I think the microfinance part of the agenda is in some ways easy, because it links up with the broader finance agenda that's already on the table. So I think for those of you who are in the microfinance business, and particularly, you know, talk to the people who run your umbrella organizations, and I know a little bit that there are some of those out there, but get them to talk to the Canadian government, very importantly for the first of the two summits next year, and get them to talk to the Korean government for the second summit. So I think there is an opportunity here. How far you get, it's difficult to say. At the moment, lots of other things on the agenda, obviously, including the climate change issue, which will very likely remain very high on a number of people's agenda. So you're competing with others trying to do the same as you are doing, and that may be not that easy.
Anne or Jean, do you want to add anything to that?
There is a consultation process now coming from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs around the G8 meeting, and we bring this concern at the table. We prefer to talk about microfinance than microcredit, but there are some windows, opportunities to talk about these strategies.
Okay. Jean?
Maybe I would like to turn the questions to my fellow presenters here. Because I would like to hear maybe Anne or Fabio talking about microcredit and the definition that we should give it to microcredit, depending in which country we are.
Why is that? As I said, I prefer to talk about financial accessibility than microcredit, because poor people, as anybody else here in the room, just think about what would be your life without your credit card, without having access to a loan, without insurance, without payment card, with the same salary. You know, you will be paid by cash at the beginning of the week, and you will have to do all your economic activities with that money. Think about how would be the life. So it's a very simple need to have access to financial services, quality of financial services. You gave some example. You know, poor people need transactional facility. They need a place to put their money safe. They need to have access to small insurance product and credit products. So they need to have access to a secure, sustainable sources of financial services. So microcredit refers to very specific methodology to be able to reach poor people, solidarity group, village banking scheme. But it's a part of the strategy, but we think that the problem is bigger than microcredit.
Okay. Well, I'd like just to comment on this. We totally agree. And when we started doing microfinance at the bank, it was exactly in the moment that many banks in Brazil were adopting this financiers, as I mentioned, yeah, as a way to take credit to the ones that were excluded. But what we believe is that, first of all, we choose to use to do microfinance what we call productive and oriented, because what I mean by this is that we would lend credit only for the ones who are entrepreneurs, not the ones who would start, because, I mean, humbly saying, we don't know how to help them to start in the very beginning, although we want at some point to work with this. But so we believe very much in the, when the small entrepreneurs grow, they might be capable of hiring more people, even if they are still informal. Yeah, they will be capable of buying more suppliers from their suppliers within the community. So this, for us, it is very visible, the changes that we are seeing in the community. So that's what we pretty much believe. That's the power of transformation in microfinance that we adopt.
Okay. We have time for one more question, and we'll break. This is Robert, who gave us a memorable presentation yesterday.
Rob Newworth, a writer from New York. I actually have three questions. So... But first,
just because you're from New York doesn't give you the right.
For Delia, I was just wondering. I know your evaluations were of particular microcredit programs, but I'm wondering if anyone has looked at, or if you know whether anyone has looked at microcredit that's just brought in from outside, as opposed to a microcredit program that might be picking up on some kind of local network, such as, like, I know in Kenya, it's not really a credit network, but all over the shantytowns and squatter communities, there are people who form these things called merry-go-rounds, and they basically contribute money every week or every month, and one member of the group just gets the money every month. And it's not exactly credit, but it's a network that trusts each other financially, and whether that would have an impact on some of what you've been finding. Can I ask the other two questions? And then
quickly,
with regard to the co-op bank program, it's just a very specific question because I'm ignorant about it, which is, does one have to be a member to get a loan?
Sure.
And therefore, the same question to you, do you go in looking, if you're starting this in other areas of Canada or in other countries, do you go in looking for local networks that already have membership, or are you starting from ground zero? And for Fabio, two things. One is that great graph that you had. I had two questions about it. One is, there was a dollar figure at the beginning, which seemed to indicate to me, and maybe I'm not understanding it correctly, that there was some kind of subsidy from outside to start the program. It said U.S. dollars AID on it. And the second question was, if you could say something about why the microcredit was flat in the favelas and then grew in the rural area. So it seems that your model is more applicable to the rural area than to the city, and I wonder why you think that is.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. Maybe we'll start with the latest and see who can remember the questions when we get down. get down to this end of the table. Fabio, do you want to...
For the record,
I don't know. Do you want to go first? Yeah,
okay.
As a gentleman.
So the question was, do you have to be a member to get a loan?
Yes, the answer is definitely yes. And we do both. We work with existing network trying to professionalize their organization, and in some countries we started from scratch because there were no institution. Maybe 40 years ago in Burkina Faso there was completely nothing when we talked about financial services. But you talked about Kenya. There's already very well structured cooperative there. Or if it's not co-op, it's community-based financial institution. There are other types of institution. And yes, we have to work with their people, their resources. And I'd like to have only a word about money. Is it better to work with the existing network? Is it better to work with the outside money, or we definitely prefer to work with local resources. In development, we talk about hot money or cold money, which is coming from outside the country. So we prefer to talk with to work with hot money, which is the money of my mother. You know, I will have a loan because my mother has savings in the same co-op, so maybe I will be shy not to reimburse. You know, it's not completely the same psychological scheme when you work with the resources of the community.
Okay, thanks. Delia, do you want to...
Quickly on the... the mechanism that you described are sometimes called RASCAs or VSLA, Village Savings and Loan Associations. And there is actually work underway with IPA in Mali in particular. I believe it's with Oxfam, is partnered with IPA to study the impact on the women that are part of this. And I also think there's another study starting up in Mozambique. So, I mean, clearly there's a strong theory why this could be quite effective, and the research is ongoing.
Okay, and final word to Fabio.
Okay, well, first, regarding the subsidies, there is none subsidies. That might be something that I wrote. I don't know. What happened was that Action, which is an international NGO, they have this expertise of setting up MFIs in South America and some knowledge as well of helping, because they helped Banco do Nordeste in the Northeast. So we asked them to join us, and obviously they are supported and sponsored by the USAID. So that was the only thing, but no subsidies. Although in Brazil we have this regulation where the 2% of the site deposits, they can be channeled to microfinance. Otherwise they have to be collected to the central bank without any interest rate on this. So that's the only incentive that we can have. Regarding favelas versus rural, I wouldn't say really, really rural. Yeah, once that credit for rural activities, very rural, probably they need some more time and a different model in terms of collecting or processing. Yeah, and also because in Brazil the government has some loans more specifically to the rural areas. In our case, the reason that we grew massively in the Northeast, whereas in the favelas we didn't advance that much, was pretty much because when we started, we were still learning. And obviously, with this learning process, we've got lots of delinquency rates. And when you, as I said, there is a huge element of relationship in it. So, as I said, we almost broke twice. So what we did was, okay, let's look at the Northeast, because it seems that the relationship aspect is very, very relevant for the success. And also there is a competitor that is doing a nice job there. So we chose to go to these areas. And I wouldn't say accidentally, but we grew a lot in there. We learned a lot in there. And now, in the last 8 months, I would say that we are growing quite a lot in the in São Paulo and in Rio. So, yes, the method, it does work in favelas. Yeah.
Okay, we've got time for one last question to the woman I can't say no to. Loret.
Okay, my question is to Johannes and also to Delia, or whoever else. I think that within the context of bringing the thinking of credit and financial empowerment within
the kind of paradigm of social determinant and health inequity, it will become very important to look at the credit intervention within the broader systems within which the intervention is being made, whether it's within country or across country. To what extent in the current thinking of, the current approach to evaluation in that domain, is there kind of a system approach, and is there also kind of looking at the economic impact in relation to social health and so on?
Sure, probably because I can talk at a slightly smaller scale. There are a number of studies that are, the ideal study does test interaction effects. What's the interaction effect between microcredit and something else, say access to health insurance? There's a couple of those that are ongoing. But one especially interesting project that's just about to start up is a research cluster in Ghana. So IPA is going to begin a research site where we can hopefully set up, again, this is a startup project at the moment, hopefully set up a research area where we can have one data collection process that collects very intensive indicators on health and well-being and income, and then allow different interventions to start simultaneously or perhaps in progression, and really with a very rich data set take a look at interaction effects.
Johannes, did you want
to? Just maybe to say that from my experience of impact evaluation, controlled experiment evaluation, there's built into it a sort of a scaling up dimension in some ways, because of course you look at various experiences, you have to have more than one data point for to see anything that's statistically valid. At the same time, I find that most impact evaluations that I've seen do not actually address the scaling up issue as an integral part of the evaluation. So we have a small pilot in India with SEVA, the women's organization, where we actually work with them in designing a scaling up oriented impact assessment evaluation to see whether that can be done, how it would be done. I think combining these two aspects, the impact evaluation, which is obviously critical, but then also at the same time figuring out whether or not and what are the factors that will allow or constrain scaling up as part of the evaluation process, from my perspective, is the direction in which one should go. So, but Delia, we need to talk because it sounds like you guys are doing lots of wonderful work, so I look forward to catching up.
You know, okay. I think we completely agree with the point of the design needs to take into account how to scale.
I have one last point for the first question. You know, what you talked about in Brazil reminds me of my children were students not so long ago, and frankly the banks in the U.S. do exactly the same things in terms of, you know, hawking the credit cards to students who don't have any money at exorbitant interest rates, as we well know. So this is a universal practice that isn't just Brazil-specific. I wanted to make
listen,
that point.
That was a splendid morning, so thank you. And we'll break for lunch now and come back.